According to a 2020 study, 9% of Americans age 12 and older are depressed. And among teens and young adults, it's 17%. And among women, single adults, and those with lower income, they're even more likely to be depressed. Suicide is the leading cause of death in America for 15 to 19-year-olds. It's a very negative subject. But it is something that our world is facing. But today I'd like to look at finding a way out, finding God's way out, finding hope. If that is something that you're facing, or if that's something that someone you know is facing, someone that you're helping. I would like to make a little disclaimer too that I'm just speaking from my experience and from what I read in the Bible. I haven't had a lot of training in this, and I realize that speaking for half an hour runs the risk of being overly simplistic. There's a lot of nuance. There's a lot of differences in what people face. And so if you're in this place, reach out. Ask for somebody to help you. Or if you're helping someone, tread softly and be careful, because I can't cover everything today, and it is difficult. So who would you say, if you look at at Bible stories, who would you say, who are some people that were depressed in the Bible? Which John? John, John the Baptist. He was questioning if Jesus was still the Christ. This was his whole job, his life's work, to come to earth and prepare the way for Christ. But he got stuck in jail and he started to doubt. Who else? Elijah. That's the one that I want to focus on today. We're gonna read about him. He definitely was quite depressed for a time in his life. How's that? Mm-hmm. Who else was depressed in the Bible? King Saul. When particularly? That is true. Who else?
Naomi.
She came back and she thought, there's no hope, there's no future. My life has been bitter. Who else?
Jacob.
When in his life are you thinking of? Before he met Joseph and they went down to Egypt. Who else? There's more. There's a lot of examples. We can't talk. Who? Solomon. When in Solomon's life? Yeah, it's all worthless. I've done all these things. I have all the money and wives and everything I could possibly want, and it's all worthless. Yeah, the children of Israel Judah there when they were trying to rebuild the walls in Jerusalem. Jonah, very much so. Maybe his whole life, I'm not sure. Or at least all of it that we know about. David, really many times through his life. It seems like I believe David must have struggled with depression on and off throughout his entire life. Psalm 42:11, he says, "Why are you in despair, O my soul? And why have you become disturbed within me? Hope in God, for I shall yet praise him, the help of my countenance and my God." And if you're struggling with depression, read Psalm 42 and 43. He's definitely struggling, but he always comes back that God is his hope. He comes back to that. Some of the Psalms are even less hopeful than that, but he definitely struggled with that. Who else? Ahab, when in Ahab's life? Oh, yes, he was depressed because he couldn't get what he wanted for his garden. And his wife tried to help him out, but I'm not sure she did such a good job. Yes, Stanley.
Was God ever
Oh no, but I would submit to you that Jesus was feeling pretty bad in the garden, Mark 14:33-36. And he took with him Peter and James and John and began to be very distressed and troubled. And he said to them, "My soul is deeply grieved to the point of death. Remain here and keep watch." And he went a little beyond them and fell to the ground and began to pray that if it were possible, the hour might pass him by. And he was saying, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." Jesus was struggling, and he's talked about God repenting of making man. Job is probably a classic example. Job 3, afterward Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth and said, Job said, "Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night which was said, a boy is conceived. May that day be darkness, and let not God above care for it, nor the light shine on it." I was wishing he had never been born. Let's turn to 1 Kings 18, verse 20. We'll start there and we'll read into chapter 19, verse 18. We want to kind of get the whole context of this story of him. I guess not the whole context, but he had just come through the three and a half years of drought when he had told Ahab it wasn't going to rain because of all he had been doing. And then he meets Ahab. So Ahab sent a message. He had asked to bring all the prophets of Baal, and we're going to have a contest of who is God. Is it Baal or is it God? So Ahab sent a message among all the sons of Israel and brought the prophets together at Mount Carmel. Elijah came near to all the people and said, "How long will you hesitate between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him." But the people did not answer him a word. Then Elijah said to the people, "I alone am left, a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Now let them give us two oxen, and let them choose one ox for themselves, and cut it up, and place it on the wood, but put no fire under it. And I will prepare the other ox, and lay it on the wood, and I will not put fire under it. Then you call in the name of your God, and I will call in the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, he is God." And all the people said, "That is a good idea." So Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose one ox for yourselves and prepare it first, for you are many, and call in the name of your God, but put no fire under it." Then they took the ox which was given them and prepared it and called on the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, "O Baal, answer us." But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they leaped upon the altar which they made. And it came about at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, "Call out with a loud voice, for he is a god. Either he is occupied, or gone aside, or is on a journey, or perhaps he is asleep and needs to be awakened." So they cried with a loud voice and cut themselves according to their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out of them. When midday was past, they raved until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, but there was no voice. No one answered and no one paid attention. Then Elijah said to all the people, "Come near to me." So all the people came near to him. And he repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. Elijah took 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, "Israel shall be your name." So with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he made a trench around the altar large enough to hold 2 measures of seed. Then he arranged the wood and cut the ox in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, "Fill 4 pitchers with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood." And he said, "Do it the second time," and they did it a second time. And he said, "Do it the third time," and they did it a third time. The water flowed around the altar and also filled the trench with water. At the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, Elijah the prophet came near and said, "O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that you are God in Israel, and I am your servant, and I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their heart back again." Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. When all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, "The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God." Then Elijah said to them, "Seize the prophets of Baal. Do not let one of them escape." So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slew them there. Now Elijah said to Ahab, "Go up, eat and drink, for there is the sound of the roar of a heavy shower." So Ahab went up to eat and drink. But Elijah went up to the top of Carmel, and he crouched down on the earth and put his face between his knees. He said to his servant, "Go up now toward the sea." So he went up and looked and said, "There is nothing." And he said, "Go back 7 times. And it came about the seventh time that he said, Behold, a cloud as small as a man's hand is coming up from the sea. And he said, Go up, say to Ahab, prepare your chariot and go down so that the heavy shower does not stop you. In a little while, the sky grew black with clouds and wind, and there was a heavy shower. And Ahab rode and went to Jezreel. And the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he girded up his loins and outran Ahab to Jezreel. Now Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, So may the gods do to me, and even more, if I do not make your life as one of them by tomorrow about this time. And he was afraid and arose for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah. So he ran all the way. Well, first he outran Ahab with his horses and chariot. And then he ran all the way down to not only out of Israel, but all the way to the southern part of Judah. And left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree. And he requested for himself that he might die. And said, It is enough now, O Lord, take my life, for I am not better than my fathers. He lay down and slept under a juniper tree, and behold, there was an angel touching him, and he said to him, Arise, eat. Then he looked, and behold, there was at his head a bread cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. So he ate and drank and lay down again. The angel of the Lord came again the second time and touched him and said, Arise, eat, because the journey is too great for you. So he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of the food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mountain of God. Then he came to a cave and lodged there, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, What are you doing here, Elijah? He said, I have been very zealous for the Lord God, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left. They seek my life to take it away. So he said, Go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord was passing by, and a great and strong wind was rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of gentle blowing. I've researched that. Sometimes it sounds, the translations are about split on that. Some say it kind of a whisper or a gentle breeze, but either way, it was soft and quiet. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entrance of the cave. And behold, a voice came to him and said, What are you doing here, Elijah? And he said, I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away. The Lord said to him, Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael king over Aram, and Jehu the son of Nimshi you shall anoint over Israel, and Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah you shall anoint as prophet in your place. And it shall come about that the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu shall put to death. And the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. And then he went on and he did those things. So as we look at this in the light of Elijah being depressed, what will you say are things that can cause depression? Not, it doesn't have to be just from this story, but what are things that can push people towards feeling depressed? Physical exhaustion. So he was tired. He ran all the way to Jezreel, and he ran, I don't know if he ran without stopping, but he ran all the way to southern Judah, which was pretty far, and he was just exhausted. What else? Fear. He was really scared of Jezebel. Right, so success. You could some people say he was a victim of his own success, and we have this adrenaline high, and after that, Satan tends to attack us. Either wants to bring us down or make us proud because of what we did, or maybe both. What else? Lack of visible results. So he had this success, but what did he have to show for it? Maybe measuring results by the wrong thing. Maybe he didn't He didn't look at things the way God does. Someone told me once that we should not judge whether we're doing the right thing by the results, but rather, have I been Christ to the people around me? There are prophets, or many people, who have done the right thing and had the wrong results. It looked like the people around them didn't change them. That didn't mean they did the wrong thing. He was doing what God had called him. He thought he was the only one left. Was he? So yes. He didn't have a community. He didn't have a church. That is a good thought. At least he didn't think he did. He wasn't with them if he did. So it's easy for us to say, all right, well, Elijah didn't know about these 7,000 people, but I don't think that's true. If you go back, he had just talked, I forget which, so Obadiah was the guy in charge of, was a pretty high up man in Ahab's kingdom. And Obadiah had been using the king's supplies to feed 100 prophets of God hidden in 2 caves. He didn't tell anyone, but he was doing this. And it is almost certain, we can't tell for sure, but Elijah talked to Obadiah about this, and he should have known that there were 100 prophets of God hiding in a cave somewhere. He maybe didn't know about the 7,000, but I think he did know about these 100 prophets of God. It would seem very likely, at least. Right. So he should have it anyway. So he wasn't quite being... But we're going to talk about that about a little later, about depressed people and the truth. What else causes depression or can cause it? I'm not going to take a lot of time. I'm going to run down through here. Hardship, failure. It can be sin in your life. Thank you very much, Titus. It can be failure, family, failure of relationships, failure in business. Yes, any kind of hardship can push us in that direction. Isolation. During the pandemic lockdowns, people were, and that pushed many people into depression, especially older folks. Hurt, and that can be all kinds of hurts, intentional or unintentional, sexual abuse, physical abuse, verbal abuse, or just something someone said struck us the wrong way unintentionally. Lies we believe can definitely push us towards depression. I'm the only one. And he said it, whether he believed it or I'm not sure. Or we can say, well, no one else ever faced anything like this. I'm the only one. Satan wants us to feel like we're isolated. No one ever faced this before. The Bible says that the temptations we face are common to man. And that Jesus faced temptations just like all the rest of us did. No one understands. No one could possibly understand what I've been through. No one's ever been through what I've been through. It's worse for me than anyone else. God doesn't care. So what are some characteristics, some symptoms of depression that would help maybe you recognize it in your own life or recognize it in other people? Withdrawal, this isolation. And that's a self-defeating thing. Isolation creates isolation. Depression creates isolation. Some of us do need, some of us more than others, do need some time alone, some time away to meditate, to think. But that's not the same thing as isolation. We need to come back.
Hanging out with the wrong crowd.
And you say, well, I'm getting help from people. But if you hang out with other people who are also depressed and you commiserate and spiral the drain together, it doesn't help. Negativity. Our words are so powerful. And if we obviously need to share difficult things sometimes, but just unnecessary negativity certainly is not healthy. One of the things I think that I see in people who are depressed is being irrational. I look at this in Elijah. It was a perfect example. He was incredibly irrational. He said, God, I want to die. Well, he could have just stayed in Jezreel, and Jezebel would have been more than happy to help him with that if that's what he really wanted. And he knew about these, he most likely knew about these 100 prophets. He said, I'm the only one. God said, no, there's 7,000. Another thing is a lack of passion and excitement. God gives us passion in our hearts, things that we get excited about. And sometimes this can look like, well, this person is submissive and they never get angry. They never, nothing ever phases them. Those can be good traits, but if you don't have any passion, nothing that excites you, there's something wrong. A desire to escape. Life is so bad, we got to escape. And this can be so many things. It can be the doom scrolling on social media or news or whatever. It can be shopping. It can be reading. It can be eating, drug and alcohol abuse, pornography, whatever. I think we all do some of this. We do things that are unhealthy when we just don't want to face what we need to face to a greater or lesser degree. And you know what yours is. But the reality is it doesn't help us solve the root problem. And there are things we can do for recreation that can help rejuvenate us, and I think there's a difference. And many of these things aren't necessarily wrong, but there's usually a healthier activity we could do. We could get some exercise, you could play with your children, you could call a friend, you can read an upbuilding book, you can have a hobby. Another thing to keep in mind when you look at depression is that it can be something satanic, something demonic, and it can be passed down from parents. It can come from something you did or somewhere you've been that gave Satan a foothold in your heart. And we could preach a whole sermon about spiritual warfare and spiritual deliverance, demonic oppression, those kind of things. But just be aware that that can be a cause of depression. And if that is the cause, anything else you do probably won't help much. But spiritual deliverance can make a dramatic difference. So next, let's look at how can we help people? If you know someone, maybe it's your family, a friend, someone you meet, how can we help people that are in this place? And I think number one, we really need to be sure and stay humble, because if you haven't struggled with depression or deep sadness in your life, you will sometime. And probably, if you haven't struggled with that, you're not the best person to help, because you're going to have a difficult time relating to that. I hope this is okay, John. A long time ago, many years ago, I said that I don't really struggle with this. I said, I struggle with being proud, but I don't struggle about getting down. And John said, you will sometime. And he was right. So stay humble, because if you haven't, you will. Another thing to do is to refresh them. And people that are down need to be refreshed. And there can be many ways to do this. Feed them healthful, nourishing food. Help them get some rest. It's amazing how much better getting enough sleep can make us feel sometimes. Another thing to do is just be with them. I was talking to a man just the other day that struggles with depression pretty much. And he said, it does so much for me when someone just is there to be with me. Don't say anything, they're just there. And I used to think that Job's friends didn't do such a good job. They sat there for 7 days. But after he said that, I took another look. I was like, what does the Bible actually say about that? And it says, then they sat down on the ground. So these men came together with him for 7 days and seven nights with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great. And I rethought that a little bit. And I wonder if they didn't do the right thing. Job didn't need them to say lots of platitudes about how he ought to be doing better. Once they started talking, it got worse. So maybe them not saying anything was the right thing. Sometimes. There's certainly a time to say things, that's for sure. Another thing is we need to be willing to listen. And we need to listen first to their hearts and their feelings before we listen to the words that they say. And acknowledge their feelings before the words, because their words will many times be irrational and literally untrue. This is the worst job in the world. And it's much better to say, I hear that you're frustrated with your job, than to say, well, actually, being a coal miner would be worse. It's not very helpful. Because their feelings are real, even if the words they're saying are not literally true. And acknowledging, I hear you saying that you're angry, frustrated, hurt, can help them feel heard. And there's a time to get to the place where God did eventually say, no, there are 7,000 people, and you need to let go of that you're the only one. But that's not the first thing he said. Their feelings are real, even if their perception of reality is not. And then be gentle. Whether it was a soft whisper or a gentle breeze that God's presence was there in, it wasn't the earthquake, and some people, maybe especially my personality, are like, come on, get over it, get out of this, you know. That's not helpful. And then ask questions. God did first, he said, what are you doing here? And then he said it again later on. We should ask some questions, get them speaking before we prescribe the fix. Another good question is, how's that working out for you? And if they're stuck, maybe help them serve others. If they're overwhelmed, help them delegate some things if they have too much to do. And then, of course, we have to talk about medication for depression. And I'm going to tell you my opinion, and then you can take that from there. You don't need to. It's somewhat controversial. I didn't realize this, and this doesn't directly apply, maybe, but I think the Bible gives us a hint about that. Proverbs 31, 6 and 7 says, give strong drink to him who is perishing, and wine to him whose life is bitter, and let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his trouble no more. Now, all throughout Proverbs, we're told not to get drunk, right? And the dangers of that. But I think maybe Proverbs is giving us a hint here that there are times when we can do something to dull the pain. Don't get me wrong, I'm not prescribing going out and getting drunk because you feel depressed. But there are places where a severe case, maybe to prevent harm to themselves or other people, and there are some things that I think we should keep in mind. It should be a last resort. It should be for a short period of time. And it should be while other things are being done to solve the root cause. It's not a solution in itself. It should be supervised by a doctor who wants to get them back off of the medication as soon as possible. Drugs can help, but there are serious trade-offs. Health side effects, and it can even blunt the mental focus that it takes to get through the depression sometimes. So I want to really be careful about that. Another thing I think we should do is we should make it okay to talk about. It's not shameful, it's reality for many people. And for probably most of us, sometime in life it's going to be reality to a greater or lesser degree. But don't shame someone who is willing to share. And also, be sensitive to the Spirit. When you sense someone else is in trouble, ask. More than just, how are you? Dig in a little bit more. I've definitely had that happen to me. Someone noticed I wasn't where I should have been and really encouraged me. I was really thankful for that. It's been very helpful. Alan K. Chalmers says, help people find the essentials of happiness. Something to do, something to love, and something to hope for. Someone else said that depression is the inability to rebuild the future. It's losing hope. And if we can help them rebuild their picture of the future, give them hope for the future, that can be very helpful. Is there anything else that you have done to be helpful, that you've found helpful to someone else if you've helped them? If not, that's fine. There's also a few things we should not do that are not helpful. And one of those is reasoning. You can't reason someone out of depression. People who are depressed are naturally irrational. We shouldn't harshly criticize people who feel depressed. God was very gentle with Elijah. We shouldn't condemn them. They're already condemning themselves. They don't need more condemnation. Don't say, well, it could be worse. Or I think even telling people all the things they have to be thankful for is not helpful. Thankfulness is a powerful antidote to depression. But maybe that's further down the road. And pointing out the good things that they have can feel pretty condescending. And like you're minimizing their hardship that they're facing. So save that for another time. Next, I'd like to take a few minutes looking at things we can do. What can I do if I'm feeling depressed? I think we need to start with recognize. Realize that you are facing this. If you don't acknowledge that you're struggling with it, there's very little chance you're going to get through it. And also look for the cause. When the red light on your dash comes on that says your car's overheating, you can ignore it and keep on driving. You can put a piece of duct tape over the red light. But it's not going to solve it. Until you find the leaky radiator hose, not going to solve it. So look for that cause. Look for the reason. And then share. Be willing to share your struggles. And that can be a really hard thing to do. Not with someone else who's also depressed and that spiral circling the drain type of commiseration, but someone who's strong, someone who can be willing to help you. Because depression isn't shameful, it's reality. And when you bring it out in the light, it can be healed. And also, we talked about isolation causing depression. Build friendships. This is a powerful antidote to that isolation that Satan wants you to be stuck in. And God has made us for relationships. He wants us to be in relationships. Also, you might need to find some counseling, but be careful. There are many counselors who would really love to take your money and create a dependency that you're coming to them for the rest of your life and make sure that you stay kind of depressed. That's not godly counsel. Find a godly counselor who won't paint you as a victim, but will help you towards freedom and victory. And be sure that they have godly biblical methods in what they're doing. Also, beware of answer people. And we all know these answer people in our lives. They have all the answers to everyone's problems. And most likely they have one or two or three things that it will solve everyone's problems in their entire life. And they often know exactly what you need before they even hear what you're facing. And they have this very hurried, simplistic diagnosis. They know exactly what you need right away. Probably not somebody that's going to help you. Another thing to do is break Satan's lies with God's truth. So you're believing lies, probably, if you're feeling depressed. God's truth is a powerful antidote to that. The feelings are powerful, and sometimes they can overwhelm the truth. So I don't remember how long ago it was. A few years ago, I drew a train up here on the board, and there were three parts to this train. One was faith, one was facts, and one was feelings. Can anybody tell me which one was the engine? Which one goes first in the train? Facts come first. The coal car's next. What's the coal car? Faith. The caboose is feelings. And who can tell me why it's very important that that train is in that order? Right, and we have the engine as facts. It is always on the tracks. It never changes. God has said these things are true and they're never going to change. And if you believe them, you're going to be on the right track. Faith. Why does that have to follow facts? My faith is not always as strong as it ought to be. But if as long as it's hitched to the facts, it's going to be going in that right direction. Sometimes my faith is really excited and it's floating up here above the tracks. Sometimes my faith is weak and it's sliding off the tracks. What about feelings? Why do they have to be in the back? They're fickle. They're really all over the place. God gave us feelings for a reason. He doesn't want us to stuff them down and not listen to our feelings. Our feelings are a good indicator, a red light on the dash to warn you when something's going wrong or going well. It's good we have them, but they have to stay hitched up behind faith and facts and faith. But they can be very, very powerful, and sometimes they can overwhelm the truth. If we get our train going the wrong way following our feelings, it's a disaster. Another thing to do if you're feeling depressed is go back to your calling. Every one of us has a calling, and maybe we don't think about it that way, but God has called us to various things in life. And write them down, maybe, in order. What are the most important things God's called you to? And often when we're feeling depressed, we've been distracted from our calling. Go back to that. And remember that God is with us through it all. God sustained Elijah with food, and he spoke to him because he was willing to listen. Confess sin, if that's been the cause. Find freedom from that. Forgive if there's hurt. Read a story about a young Vietnamese woman who was killed during the Vietnam War, and she left, leaving her husband and young son. The husband, needing to provide for himself and the boy, traveled far and wide looking for odd jobs. Often he left the child with neighbors. After one long trip looking for work, the man returned to find his village demolished and his neighbors gone. Searching through the rubble, he found scattered about small bones. He was sure that they were the remains of his beloved son. He wrapped the bones in cloth and carried them with him everywhere he went. Many years passed, and one night, the old man heard a knocking on the door. He called out, "Who's there?" "It's your son," the voice outside replied. "My kidnapper set me free, and I have spent many years trying to find you." The old man yelled, "You're a fake and a cruel man. My son is dead. Leave me alone." And he would not open the door. The pounding continued for a while, but then it stopped. The young man gave up and left. The old man never found happiness in his lost son, who was still living. Why? Because he was determined to hold on to the old bones of the past. Sometimes our pain gets so familiar and comfortable to us, we don't want to let it go. We want to hang on to it. And we keep nursing that wound because we're just so used to it. And it keeps us from ever finding healing. Another thing to do is take care of your body. Eat well, drink enough, drink plenty of water, sleep the right amount if you can. Sometimes it's hard to sleep if you're feeling depressed. But do an effort. Make an effort to sleep as much as you should. Or sometimes it makes it hard to get up and we don't want to get out of bed. Do that too. Exercise. Another thing to do is focus outside yourself. When we face hurt, it turns our focus inward because we face this hurt. And to a certain point, that's necessary. We need to acknowledge what went wrong and find a solution. But it can make us very selfish if we continue to stay there. So turn that focus outward again and begin to serve others, help others. And then letting God heal those hurts can prepare us to serve other people and help other people who have been hurt in the same way that we have. Another important thing to do is look for God working through the pain. All things work together for good if we love God. And God will turn every bad thing we've ever faced into something good if we allow him to do that. And I have a pretty long thing I'd like to read here. We'll get to that, but we'll get to that in a little bit. We might never fully see the good results of the bad things we've faced in this life, but if we believe it, it can be a help. And depression can be a catalyst to change. It can be that indicator. Look, you need a new radiator hose. 2 Corinthians 4:8, we are afflicted in every way but not crushed, perplexed but not despairing, persecuted but not forsaken, struck down but not destroyed. Jumping down to verse 16, therefore we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison, while we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. This is a story. Last week in Sunday school class I was teaching, someone asked about being delivered from depression. I noted that God is surely able to do so, but I tried to give another perspective on this, that pain may actually be a means of blessing. As C.S. Lewis observed, pain is God's megaphone to rouse a dulled world. In our culture, we have a tendency to be preoccupied with the alleviation of pain. But there is a danger. We can become so absorbed with recovery from pain that we make this a higher priority than knowing Christ or being delivered from sin. Do we find ourselves more upset with our discomfort than our lack of Christ-likeness and sin? Our main problem is not pain. Alienation from God and idolatry and sin are. Once we realize that God is not obligated to take our pain away, as Paul experienced with his thorn in the flesh, our relationship with God can be enriched and deepened. We are living and even hobbling about in a fallen world, in anticipation of the new heavens and earth. Christ offers us hope and grace in the midst of suffering, not always relief from it. Theologian Vernon Grounds eloquently writes, "An individual quite completely free from tension, anxiety, and conflict may only be a well-adjusted sinner who is dangerously maladjusted to God. And it is infinitely better to be a neurotic saint than a healthy-minded sinner. Healthy-mindedness may be a spiritual hazard that keeps an individual from turning to God, precisely because he has no acute sense of God. Tension, conflict, and anxiety, even to the point of mental illness, may be a cross voluntarily carried in God's service." Paul reminds us that it is often in our weakness and inadequacy that we are often most conscious of Christ's power resting upon us. "When I am weak, then I am strong." Having God's power means that we can please God whatever our circumstances or condition. I think of my grandmother, who, though bedridden, always had such a sweet, gracious demeanor. She never complained. Christ's power enabled her and enables us to carry out God's will and purposes despite our weakness and frailty. Consider the powerful British preacher Charles Spurgeon would be laid up in bed for long stretches of time due to depression, yet he was a remarkable instrument of God. Or think of the noted hymn writer and friend of John Newton, William Cowper, who battled severe depression as well, yet he used this man's gifts to bless the church. And John Cowper has written some of our songs. I'd like to sing one of his. I should have looked up the number. "God Moves in a Mysterious Way," if you don't mind. And think about that as we sing that song. We'll sing it after. I'm almost finished here. Think of that and you can see him struggling with depression as you go through that song. If we allow it, weakness and pain may open our eyes to see how much we need God and prompt us to cast ourselves upon his mercy. As Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 1:9, "Indeed, we had the sentence of death within ourselves in order that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead." And I think we need to remember, God leads us through discouraging circumstances, through depression. David said, "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me." And it can be a comfort to know that God's there with us. But we also need to know that God didn't say we're going to set up camp in the valley of the shadow of death. He takes us through it. So remember that it is something we need to go through. We can't set up camp and live there. Another thing is to be thankful. Look for the things to be thankful for. And that probably works a lot better on our own than coached by someone else. Another thing to do is act on the things you can change and acknowledge the things that you can't. Take responsibility for your own choices and your own actions and what you can change. But realize that there are many things and many people in life that are never going to change. Or they might not. Because some of us take on guilt that belongs to other people. God puts that guilt on them, but it's not ours to carry. Find encouraging Bible verses. The Psalms can be a good source of that because David struggled with that. So as you do that, I would like to just take a little time and have a time of prayer for anyone who's struggling with that right now. So let's just bow our heads and have a time of prayer, and then we'll sing that song, Cleon. Let's pray. Dear God, I thank you for the story of Elijah and how he was able to walk through that very difficult, scary time of his life, that dark time, and to come out the other side and to delegate some of his responsibilities to again serve you. And I pray that you would help each person here who is struggling with that, with a dark time, a dark night of the soul, a time of depression and sadness, whatever brought that on. I pray that you would help each person here to be able to find that delivery and freedom, find the passion in their life, find their calling again so that they could again serve you with joy. I pray that you would help each of us to hold each other up, carry each other's burdens, bear each other's burdens when we go through those dark times. Help us to have love. Help us to have discernment to see when our brothers and sisters are walking through that and to be a blessing, to be an encouragement to them. Help us to always be thankful for the good things that you've given to us so that we can live in that thankfulness and joy that you want us to come back to once again. In Jesus' name, amen.